The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to introduce our guest this evening. Chinalo Okparanta's acclaimed debut novel, Under the Udala Tree, was selected for more than a dozen periodicals' 2015 Best Of lists, won a Lambda Literary Award, and was a finalist for the International Dublin Literary Award. She's also the author of the short story collection, Happiness Like Water, winner of an O. Henry Prize. Her many other awards and honors include distinguished fellowships, faculty appointments, and visiting professorships. She is currently Associate Professor of English and Director of the Program in Creative Writing at Swarthmore College. Her latest work is Harry Sylvester Byrd, a satirical novel about a young white man's education and miseducation in contemporary America. This evening, she will be joined in conversation with Asali Solomon, author of two novels and a short story collection, and a professor of fiction writing and literature of the African diaspora at Haverford College. Please join me in welcoming our guests to the Free Library.
Hello. So you're going to read first, right?
Yes, I am. Hi, everyone. It's so lovely to see you. Okay, so I will read from Harry Sylvester Byrd. I'll read just the beginning of the novel and then a second excerpt from a little, still the beginning, but a few pages in. So this is when Harry and his family are arriving at the resort. We arrived at the resort in the afternoon when the sun was rising above the army of palm trees, lined and fanning in the breeze like windmills in the brightening orange and blue. Chevrolet and Wayne, I refused to call them Mom and Dad, had remained silent for the 45-minute drive from the airport, except for brief responses to the white-capped, white-gowned driver, such as when the driver asked if they'd be needing the Wi-Fi access code, and they both nodded and said yes and thank you at once. In the spirit of solidarity, I nodded too, but the signal had been weak and the connection elusive, and soon Wayne and Chevy leaned into their separate windows, I in the middle, and zoned out as if they were sleeping with their eyes open. When the driver pulled up to the resort's gate, the Maasai warrior, with his red and pink shuka, his cowhide sandals, and his wooden club, rose from his bamboo stool and inspected our car before waving us in. All in an instant, the resort emerged before us like a tropical paradise. Behold, before my eyes, conical thatched makuti roofs, flanked by the green fronds of the palm trees, white hammocks dangling between the stems, gold-trimmed lounge chairs with rolling arms and claw foots, white-beamed umbrellas, and in every direction, lush and low-lying tulip and hibiscus bushes. Wayne and Chevy had fought on the plane and before getting on the plane and before that, and I had begun to think that perhaps for once they had grown satiated with their fighting for the day. But as we stepped out of the cab, a new fight materialized. The taxi service had been included in the booking, but who would pay for the tip, and how much to tip? I was only 14 and without any income other than the occasional allowance, but knowing them, they would have had me pay if they thought I could have somehow managed it. My stomach knotted with their bickering, palm sweaty, head full and woozy, as if the car sickness were not enough, now this fight. Wayne said, "Honey, it's Africa. $1 is enough for a year's living. You don't need to give them more than that." "Fine, I'll get it this time." But it was nearly an hour drive, Chevy said. "I don't see what giving $5 will hurt." In the end, they settled on $2, 2 years' income, Wayne said, for less than an hour's drive. Chevy narrowed her eyes at him, then walked away, dragging her luggage along. I followed Chevy. Of the two, she was the one to follow. Wayne often erred too far on the side of harshness, of cruelty. "Treat others the way you would not like to be treated," it seemed to me what was his motto. No golden rule for him. With Chevy, at least sometimes there were surprises. As I rolled my luggage away, I heard the driver softly say "Asante," and maybe the driver truly was grateful. Gratitude in principle and by practice. I knew a bit about that. This was late December, and our Christmas tree had been an oversized mother-in-law's tongue in a tall maroon urn. It was a houseplant that we'd owned for the preceding half decade. Wayne had insisted it was the perfect segue into our Africa safari trip. Chevy had insisted that Christmas was its own event and deserved its own tree. Why spend the money after he had doled out so much on the impending tree, Wayne had asked. "Well," Chevy answered. We laid our three gifts under the plant. My Christmas gift from them had been a nail clipper wrapped in an empty matchbox. Nothing to brag about. Still, I had made a practice of gratitude, a notion that I had stumbled upon on the internet, and so I was grateful for the gift. And after all, nails grew and would always need clipping. Maybe this was how the driver saw it too, a practical sort of gratitude. And the second section that I'll read, the second excerpt, is just a little bit farther into the novel when they are at what is called Camp TV. And you just get to see a little bit more of the parents, because sometimes, you know, we wonder how it is that Harry became how Harry is. And the answer, sorry, parents. The parents. Okay, well, somewhat the parents, actually. We also become who we are going to be. Okay, page 32. Outside, the stars sprinkled the sky like grains of salt. The air smelled crisp like an open freezer, or like that gap in seasons between the Pennsylvania fall and winter. At Camp TV, the oily scent of the triangular snacks that looked like spanakopita drifted in the air. I grabbed a handful of them, then found a spot by two empty chairs at the edge of Camp TV. The food had a kick to it, and some heat, like the swelter of a McDonald's or Burger King spicy crispy chicken sandwich, except more. More pepper, more fire, an African twist, I suppose. Voices rose and fell as the hosts took drink orders. The food was causing me to sweat a little. I asked for a glass of water, glancing around in search of Benson, but he was nowhere to be seen. My eyes landed on my parents just as I placed my order. It was the anarchy of Wayne's mannerisms, like a body and a mind at war with each other, that caught my attention. He had clearly had too much to drink. Chevy sat rigidly like a block of ice, refusing to melt. I devoured the hors d'oeuvre, especially the spanakopita, despite its heat. After some time, I decided that I was sufficiently full and that I should head back to bed and try my best to forget what I'd just witnessed. I might, of course, have stayed if the darkest man had been there. I would have loved nothing more than to be in his presence, the way people crave to be in the presence of their heroes, the way we all crave to be in the presence of our aspirational selves. But alas, Benson was not there. All I needed now was that glass of water. I'd hardly risen from my seat when Wayne's voice boomed. "Young lady," I said, "could I have another beer?" There was a silence before a camp host, a bald young man, approached with a beer on a tray. Wayne refused the server's beer. "Young lady," I said, "I'd like another beer." The young woman whom Wayne was addressing now turned to face him. "Sir, I've told you before, I don't work at the camp." Near her sat another young woman. They looked vaguely alike. They must have been around the same age, in their early or mid-20s. Old enough to be the ages of any of the younger teachers in my school, say Miss Rice, but not old enough to be the age of Mrs. Smith, the school librarian, and certainly not old enough to be my parents' ages. "Where are you from?" Wayne asked. I shook my head in horror. "We're from Ghana," the second young woman said. "Ghana?" Wayne asked. "Yes," both women said at once, seeming bemused. "Why are you here if you're from Africa?" "Excuse me?" the first woman asked in what appeared to be an honestly inquisitive sort of way. For a moment, I thought that perhaps she really had not heard the question. "I said, why are you here if you're from Africa?" Wayne repeated. "Ah, I see," the woman said. "Probably the same reason you're here, to see the animals, to experience the beauty of Serengeti." "But you're African," Wayne said. "Sir, can I offer you this beer now?" the Camp Nala host asked. "Our safari is only to be enjoyed by non-Africans," the second black young woman said. "But you can see for yourself," Wayne said, extending his hand in an expansive way as if to show the audience to her. "You're the only black guests here." "Oh, Charlie," the first black young woman said. "Pardon me. It must have been written somewhere in the book of life that safaris are only to be enjoyed by whites, yeah? The beauty of Africa is something to be experienced by white people alone." "Please, sir," the host begged, "take your beer." The first black young woman stood up at her friend's urging. Together, they walked away from Wayne until they reached the area on the edge of the camp where I sat, cringing, my thighs so stiffly joined together that they ached. The first woman's body seemed made of prickly things. She shook herself off as if to dislodge some pesky burrs, so agitated was she by the whole incident. "It's all right," the second woman was saying. "He's drunk. He doesn't know what he's saying." "He knows exactly what he's saying," the first woman said. After a while, the first woman seemed to have calmed down, and then her eyes landed on me. "Oh," she said, "I didn't realize you were there." "Yeah," I croaked. "What's your name?" she asked. "I'm Essie, and this is my sister Nanama," the second one said, smiling. "I'm Harry," I said. "You're not here by yourself, are you?" Essie asked. "No," I said, pointing dejectedly to my parents. "Those are my folks." "Ah," Nanama said. "Poor thing," she exclaimed softly, almost in a whisper. And I'll stop there.
So that was cool to hear in your voice. And so I have a lot of questions. Talk about where this character came from.
So Harry is a character that really just sort of materialized. In, I believe it was early 2016, I was teaching a course on the ethics of writing other cultures at Columbia University. And I, you know, for that course, we read books such as Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad. We read articles by, for instance, one article by Chinua Achebe that was published in the Massachusetts Review where he discussed the Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, right.
And then we read other books that write, you know, other cultures, like Memoirs of a Geisha. We read Adam Johnston's The Orphan Master's Son, and just many other books. And I was always intrigued by the way the conversations were so polarized, mm-hmm. right? So some people felt that it was completely fine and within the writer's rights to write whatever they wanted, doesn't matter. But then others thought, you know, like, you just simply can't do this. And actually at the time, I thought, no, you can't do this because it's a question of power, the power dynamics, right? You have to be careful where you stand in the whole idea of power privilege and also where the other culture stands when you're writing something that is not of your own culture. And so these were conversations that we went back and forth on. Another novel that we discussed, actually we discussed two novels by this writer. I don't know if anyone's read William Styron, but William Styron wrote The Confessions of Nat Turner, and William Styron also wrote Sophie's Choice. And if you've read both novels, they were controversial for, I would say, different reasons, but also very similar reasons, right? So in Confessions of Nat Turner, William Styron writes about a real-life African-American man who was a slave in Virginia at the time. And the way he writes this man is in such a way that the slave becomes the monster. And we almost forget that Nat Turner is simply trying to get his freedom. What we come out with at the end of The Confessions of Nat Turner is this sort of empathy towards the white slave owners, right? Where we should feel bad for them for having lost their lives in the fight for these people trying to get their freedom, right, from slavery. So it was a, you know, questionable book, and one of the big commenters on that book was James Baldwin, who said, well, no one can tell a writer what he or she can write about, which was an interesting thing. So we listened to recording of James Baldwin, but we also discussed what James Baldwin said. Ossie Davis came and said no. Basically, he was saying that if the situation with racism in the country were to not be existent anymore, if we have solved that problem, then sure, the writer can write whatever they want. But as we haven't yet solved that problem, that he disagrees basically with James Baldwin. Then in Sophie's Choice, Styron does something similar but also different, because he doesn't rewrite the story of a real man making the real man a monster, and also a raging rapist, by the way. But in this case, he rewrites the story of the Holocaust, and he makes the primary victim of the Holocaust a Catholic, right? A Catholic person, basically, she was not, that demographic was not the primary victim of the Holocaust. So,
to say the least.
Right. So the Jewish readers, you know, took offense at it and had, you know, legitimate complaints about the novel. So there were things that, you know, people did not love about what William Styron was doing. But that was a good subject of conversation for a novel, because as we all know, William Styron, Sophie's Choice, and Confessions of Nat Turner both went on to do extremely well, to get a lot of critical acclaim, right? So there was this, you know, conversation surrounding the politics of why such a thing happens, who gets to write what stories, who gets rewarded for writing certain stories, how that affects the power dynamics of things as well. And I thought that these conversations were super interesting. I did not think, this is a long answer to your question.
You'll get there.
Yes, I will eventually. It's a journey. But I hadn't thought about the character of Harry at the time. I was just really interested in teaching a course like this, and also interested in people's take on the subject, you know? But over the years, so after that, I moved on to teach at Bucknell, where I taught the same course and we discussed these issues. And I was also living in Lewisburg, which is, you know, a sort of kind of small town, maybe sort of rural area. And I was living there at the time, in 2016, I moved in June, July-ish, started teaching in August. It was a very fraught time for the nation, right? So I was a Black African woman in the middle of Lewisburg, hearing interesting things about, like, race and immigration. People felt open to say things to me, you know, being a Black woman and feeling that, again, that idea of power. They now had the power and they could say what they wanted to say. And I sort of had to endure it privately. And I remember at some point I did visit the town of Centralia, which is very close by, and there were white power signs everywhere, and it was just very disturbing, and people didn't seem that bothered. And at some point, one colleague said, oh, why, don't let it bother you, just let it wash over you, you know? And I was like, it is, again, that power, right, where you are in the position to not notice or just tell me to let it wash over me, but I'm there, like, this is having an effect on me, my body, my psyche, my emotions, right? And it isn't so easy to let it wash over me. So I think together, all of those experiences, you know, came together and sort of led to, I guess, this kind of story where I really did believe that many people were actually well-intentioned, right? In saying to me, let it wash over you, that's, you know, somebody who cares and is trying to let me not feel, you know, not worry about these, you know, microaggressions. And if you want to say, you know, the bigger word, like racism, like racist, you know, basically racism. It just really, in my mind, sort of came together as a story about what does it look like when a character is super well-intentioned, but in a way that they almost, well, they do hyper-correct, right? They correct themselves so much that they are as offensive or even more offensive than what they're trying to correct. And that really, I wound up with the character of Harry Sylvester Byrd, who is a very well-meaning young man who hyper-corrects and becomes maybe as offensive or more offensive than his parents.
One of the things you're talking about your class, where you were teaching works that were written about other groups of people by, you know, white, some white writers, mainly it sounds like white writers, but I cannot think of another novel that I have read that is by a black woman writer that is about a white male protagonist. Like, I even did a little Googling, nothing came up. Did you have any apprehensions about that? Did you feel like you were taking risks? And also, what was the sort of thing that squashed the feeling of fear about that, if there was any fear?
Oh, I'm still afraid. There was definitely fear. I don't feel that I've done anything super, super brave in my life until I read this book. I mean, if I become a parent, then that'll be the bravest thing I've ever done.
It will just mean you won't know what you're getting into.
Yeah. Every day will be an act of bravery if I become a parent. But but I'll say that, let's see, where to begin the question? Yeah, I was very afraid. But that being said, you know, like I teach these power dynamic courses, basically, right? And I, you know, we've all, I think most of us have studied Toni Morrison. And when Toni Morrison talks about this white gaze, right, that whole idea of being the gaze that basically is, what is the word she says? Basically, like, this is the gaze that says, yeah, you're okay, you're legitimate now, right? But that gaze is always a little bit skewed, right? It's always it's always culturally incomplete at the very best, right? And then even beyond that, it's usually catering to a white audience, right? So I wanted to flip that gaze a little bit, right? So I was like, well, if the world is becoming as equal as we'd like to believe that it is not equal. But, you know, for others of us to seize that same power, mm-hmm. to see what it feels like to write, which also I think will give white people sort of the permission to, I guess, keep doing, if we can all enjoy that privilege, right? If we can all enjoy that privilege, then maybe the terrain will then be a little bit more equal. I think we should, you know, enjoy the privilege with caution, with a little bit of respect, which is why I cautiously decided to write the novel as a satire, right? It is overblown. There's a point to it. It's a critique of that kind of literature, right? And there are many great writers, like Joseph Conrad is an astonishing artist. This is not to, you know, denigrate, interesting word, to denigrate, yeah. The Heart of Darkness in terms of its aesthetic, artistic value, right? That has nothing to do with it, but it's just to talk about these conversations of what we're doing, what we're inadvertently doing in literature and how it affects us socioculturally, right? And historically, and with power dynamics, with history, and all of that, right? This is a book that's having that kind of conversation with our histories, right? It's having the conversation with our politics, and it's kind of talking back to it in a, like, aware way, right? It's aware of what it's doing. Now, that's the risk when you write a satirical book, is you run a risk of people not getting it, because satire is really hard to write, and I've studied satire. I was telling Asali that I've studied satire from way back when. I did my master's in the 17th and 18th century British literature, so the Restoration era, where I read a lot of satirical novels, and I've been following satirical novels till contemporary times. But in any case, it's a very hard genre to pull off, right? So that in itself is super risky. I've had to, you know, hear people have like sort of knee-jerk reactions to the book, and it is not the kind of book you read and you know, like make a verdict on right away. But because we're used to that kind of literature, we want to make, you know, knee-jerk verdicts on a book like this. And I just, you know, I would say like, sit with it. It's uncomfortable. It's okay to sit with the discomfort. There's a point to it.
To that point, I found Harry, and by the way, later in the book, spoiler alert, he goes by G-Dog, to be he was a very weird mix of extremely unappealing but empathetic. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I take it that this is achieved partially by just seeing him in this extreme situation with his parents, but how did you feel about this character as you were writing him? And how did you feel writing all, you know, the different, what about the parents who were just like incredibly emotionally abusive? Yeah. What was your experience of hanging out with these people as a writer?
Yeah, it sucked. It was like being confined in a room with really abusive people. But it was also fine because it's all a balancing act. And that's the other thing. Like, this is a book that also reveals a lot about our society and how we digest things, because I would agree with you, Asali, that he's really empathetic, but I hear a lot of people saying he's terrible. Yes, he's terrible, but he can be both. Do you know what I mean? He really is terrible, but there's a way in which if you create that backstory, that background with seeing the ways in which he is informed, he's aware of you know, the history, societal implications of certain things, but he doesn't know what to do with it. He doesn't know how to move forward, right? That's where he gets stuck and becomes a little bit, you know, not the nicest, not the greatest character, right? In some ways, we want to hate him, but that's, again, another knee-jerk reaction, because I don't think he's completely somebody we should just wholesale throw out, right? There's a reason for characters like Harry, right? So we've all, by this time, I'm sure, read like Albert Camus' The Stranger, which is a book I like to talk about, where the protagonist is completely unlikable, right? I don't know how many, I don't want to ask how many people read it, but basically this is a guy who like attends the mother's funeral, doesn't even want to go to his mother's funeral, doesn't really care, is worried about his coffee and smoking while his mother is being buried. He doesn't cry, he sheds no tears, he goes on to watch movies and like basically sleep with a girlfriend who he doesn't really care about. And when he's, sorry to spoil it for you, but it goes on and on basically. Not a likable character, but then he becomes the study for like existentialism, right? So why is it that certain characters, despite being unlikable, are meaningful to us through literature? And I was also channeling those kind of unlikable characters when I wrote Harry. There are things that we can take out of a character like Harry. We can take from a character like Harry. There's a point of my writing a character like him, right? Mm-hmm. You know.
Did you learn anything from writing this? Because I feel like a big part of this is, I mean, anytime you sit down to write anything, even if you were writing about, you know, a young woman raised in Nigeria who moved to the United States, you would learn something, right? But there's a bigger gulf between your experience and the experience of, like, a white boy growing up in one of these Helltown, Pennsylvania places. No offense if you're from Helltown, Pennsylvania. What are something maybe you learned from that?
I mean, I learned a lot of things. I'll say I'm still learning because I think the novel is sort of a social experiment whereby I will learn more from how the novel is received, right? So there's a sort of social experimentalism that is going on with this novel. So it'll be just, I'm already learning things by how it's being received because I'm learning where I fall in the power of things because I've studied literature so much that I can see the hierarchy of who goes where, even when they're doing similar works. And like, I'm a Black woman, basically supposedly the bottom of the totem pole, right? So I'm ready for people to say, it's worthless, da da da. But that being said, what I have learned, what I did learn while writing it, is that the nation is really fraught, right? And actually, beyond the nation, globally, we have so much more work to do, right? We have a lot of work to do because sometimes we think that we're operating from our, you know, little bubble in the U.S., and yeah, we're getting somewhere, but you know what they say, that healing is not linear, right? So it's possible that we're in a period of regression, and I really felt that as I was writing the novel, because actually several of the events in this novel actually happened in real life, not exactly the same way they're fictionalized, right? But they were inspired by real life events that happened. For instance, the man at the safari who thinks that safari should be enjoyed by only whites is real. Like, it's based on a real life person who felt the same way. These things are, I didn't completely make up everything. They're inspired, you know, like by real life events, right? So we just have a lot of work to do, right? I was realizing how race is even more of a fraught topic than I thought it was, right? And it's not just nationally, but it's also globally, right?
So a question I have about, and I think we might be nearing the end of our conversation, but the novel is set, I was sort of wondering about your timeline because you decided to actually write about COVID, and also it's like sort of moves into a near future, like a sort of dystopian, really like polarized almost to the point of civil war America. Why did you decide to set it, like, how did you decide to take that temporal approach?
Even from the beginning, it was sort of an alternate USA, right? So there is not a real third party politics going on in the US right now. But I created that because I didn't want it to be exactly the way it is here now, because I thought it would allow people to enter the novel a little bit more easily. But that might or might not be true. But even where COVID is concerned, you know, I started writing the novel before the pandemic hit. And then I thought to myself, I still want the novel to be realist to an extent, but also alternate close reality, right? Mm-hmm. So something that is slightly different from our reality. So, and the truth is, the novel goes beyond where we are right now, right? So it goes into the future. I didn't know how COVID was going to end up. COVID hasn't ended yet, you know? So I didn't want to play with that reality guessing game. I wanted to create just my own fictional narrative that was close enough to reality but different enough. And so that's how I created, you know, the pandemic bubbles and registration, basically a registry for the COVID pandemic and et cetera, et cetera. And I did put an end date in the novel for the pandemic, so hopefully it ends by then, but, you know, if not. But I just didn't want it to be exactly as things are, because there's no way I would know exactly how things would be, but I wanted to also allow us room to discuss real issues that we are having.
So who are some of the artists or authors that you're writing towards as, like, goal or inspiration or even in conversation with?
I'd say I'm in conversation with quite a bunch of writers. Inspiration, that's, you know, in some ways different but similar. But, you know, one of the authors who always speaks to me is Toni Morrison. I mentioned her. I love the moral weight of The Bluest Eye, which some people would say, well, it's overdoing it, but it isn't, you know. I'm in conversation with Paul Beatty's The Sellout, which I think is an equal opportunity satire. So I love it. It's also one of those books that you have to, you know, you have to be ready to read, and you really have to be ready to digest, right? So I think that's a very wonderful, clever novel. I'm also in conversation with historical novels. Like, if you've read, again, I had this history with satire, so I've read Voltaire's Candide. I've read Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels, which is actually interestingly divided into sections in which Gulliver is going within different countries, right? Sort of the way Harry is traveling from, you know, place to place, in a sense, trying to, you know, make sense of the world in a way. I'm in conversation with, in some ways, with Alan Mabonku, who is a Congolese author who wrote Black Moses. And that's a picaresque novel, which it's a modern picaresque novel. And if you've read anything about, if you've heard anything about a picaresque novel, you know that it is a novel where there's, you know, like a young man usually, usually not of the highest social class. And he's, you know, sort of not of the highest quality of morality, right? Questionable morality. And he's trying to make his way, like he's trying to make the best out of his circumstances and trying to basically understand the world. And the world that that kind of character usually finds himself in is a very corrupt world. So there's a way in which Harry is also a sort of modern day picaresque novel, very satiric, which is also a quality of a picaresque novel. So there are lots of different books mm-hmm. that the novel is in conversation with. But in general, it's even in conversation with TV shows like The Simpsons, you mm-hmm. know, like all these like over, like sort of exaggerated commentary on our society, you know, and that's really what the book is doing.
All right, so now we will open up for our audience question.
Hi, I just want to know, how did you come up with the name? I love the name Harry, Sylvester also, and Bird. It's just so fun, along with the colors of the book. But I always associate that name with something good, like, you know, the Prince Harry, Harry Potter, or so on, and Sylvester. Just really, I get this fun feeling, so... was that intentional?
Literally, Harry Sylvester Bird came together that way. Harry Sylvester Bird, and it felt fitting. So what I did was I looked up each name. I looked up Harry. And Harry, I thought, was also fitting when I looked up the meaning. Harry being like sort of harried, agitated, person who is not quite comfortable with where they are. And I thought it was fitting for him, because he's not comfortable with the circumstances of his birth, basically, right? He's not comfortable with the family in which he finds himself. He's not comfortable with the town in which he finds himself. He wants to leave. So that idea of a person being frazzled, agitated, worked for the first name. I then looked up Sylvester, and Sylvester is sort of speaking to, like, of the wild, of the forest, that sort of thing. And I thought, I think it works. It works because there's something a little bit wild about Harry. But even beyond that, this is a person who, again, feels a connection to, if you would be like Joseph Conrad, the heart of the dark. Like, he's into Africa, which they would consider sort of like the forest, you know. And so I thought, Sylvester's fine for him. And then I looked up Bird, and well, we don't need to look up Bird that much. We know the symbolism for Bird, what you talk about, the freedom, almost even peace. And Harry is a person who is in search of his freedom from what he might call his inherited burdens, right? So he wants to be free from this history of slavery. He wants to be free from racism. He wants to do better, be better, find himself in a better place. He really wants to be free, right? And so I thought that works as a name as well. But I know that when people think about, especially Sylvester Bird, like they think of Looney Tunes, like, but I thought about it and I said, it's okay. That's also a fine connection too.
Other questions? While you think of your questions, I was also going to ask you why you decided to title the book after him. I mean, you know, presumably there were other things you thought about that you could have titled it.
Presumably, yes, but no. it just always worked that Harry Sylvester Byrd was going to be it. And I thought it was the most fitting thing because it is about his journey. Mm-hmm. You know, he is the character that I was trying to highlight. And it was also an interesting title for the reasons, you know, the audience member brings up, just the questions that come up, you know, like, and the connections that we, the associations we make with it will make us interested in wanting to read it and, you know, find meaning in it.
Hi, I really appreciated the question and your answer on your influences and who you think you're in conversation with. And I'm wondering what other media, TV shows, movies, or books you think are critical to better understand, like satire, to better understand sort of what you're pointing at in your novel.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. I've basically mentioned quite a bit of them. I could go on. I mean, there's Oreo. There's, I think you mentioned a TV show, Atlanta?
Oh, yeah, Atlanta.
Yeah, I haven't actually watched it. But I'll say that all you have to do, because I have a long list and I can give you the names personally, but all you have to do is just go back and look at, go online, these days you can find anything, and just look up the list of satirical novels. They're actually more than we realize, right? There are many novels that are doing work satirically. There's Nana, he's a Ghanaian writer who wrote Friday Black. Sorry about that. And it's a collection of short stories that are actually quite, they're kind of doing this similar work as Harry Sylvester Byrd, as in the sense of it's a social critique, it's contemporary, but they're short stories instead, and it's just looking at, life in the U.S. from a black person's POV, and what's interesting about it is generally a black African person's perspective, mm-hmm. which is what's different, right, about Harry Sylvester Byrd as well. It's, in fact, with Harry Sylvester Byrd, there are multiple layers, right? So it's looking at the U.S. critically, racially, but the main gaze is this black African female writer who is then narrating it via a white American male who wants to be a black, or who believes he is a black African person, right? So there are multiple layers, and I think while Nana's book is not doing exactly the same thing, but there are connections to that. So there are quite a number of books that you can look at that would actually be, I guess, instrumental, informational, for you, yeah.
Will you do the audiobook?
Will I do the audiobook?
Yeah, will you do the audiobook? I just love the idea of it, you being Wayne Chevy and Harry Sylvester Byrd. No.
Well, that might be fun, but not for me. Yeah, like Robert Petkoff, who I think is actually a brilliant reader, is doing. I did ask Trevor Noah to do it because I think like
that
he gets
awesome,
it, you know,
yeah.
Like as an African, he'll get the, and he's funny, right?
Yeah.
So like people will get the comedy more readily than if they're getting it from me. So I thought he would be great, but I don't think we had enough money to pay him. But that, I don't know, actually, I'm making that up. That's not what he said at all. Like, I don't know what ended up happening, but I would have loved him. I think he's great. I think he narrated his novel, Born a Crime, and I thought it was beautifully narrated, so I really wanted him to do it. But I also found a bunch of other audiobook narrators really excellent, and one of them was Robert Petkoff, who is the narrator of the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Less. And he is the one who ended up narrating it, and I think he's done an amazing job.
Going back to the class that you taught about who gets to write what stories, I read something recently that said that, well, you can write something even if it's not part of your experience if you do the research. So does that address the power dynamic issue, and how do you feel about that in general?
Well, it's complicated. See, that's the thing, because the world is not an equal place and research can be limited. So sometimes when we think that we are doing our best with the research, there's a whole lot more that we're missing, because sometimes we are our own blind spots, you know? So I don't have an answer to that question. I think that sometimes research is enough and sometimes it isn't. I think that even when people encourage you to go and speak with quote unquote the locals and see what life is like, sometimes even that is not enough. You know, like I was, even as an African, I was careful because some of the countries that I'm visiting here, I am not from those countries. I'm not from Tanzania. I'm not from Ghana. I've been, you know, Ghana is like right next to my country. We're like cousins, you know. Tanzania a little bit farther off, so like maybe we're like, I don't know, long lost relatives or something. But I was still so careful and cautious to only write of those countries from, even from with my characters, only as tourists. I was never going to pretend to know anything more than just from the tourist perspective, right? Because in as much as I am trying to speak back to racial and power inequalities, I'm also trying my hardest to do that without being guilty of what I'm, you know, trying to discuss or bring to light, right? And so did I succeed 100%? Probably not. None of us will, right? So we love the orphan master's son, right? But has any of us gone down to Korea to ask the Koreans what they actually think? I love that book. I teach that book, right? But you won't actually know the same way we did it. Many people didn't know how actual Africans felt about, you know, the heart of darkness, right? Until Africans started speaking about the literature, right? So it's really difficult. And then also not all Africans will be, you know, Africa is not a country, but like not all Africans will be on the same page about it. So whenever you create art, you anyway have to be okay. You have to be, first of all, aware of what the potential consequences could be, and you have to make sure that you're okay with those, that like your conscience is fine with it. And then you have to create the art that you want to create and hope you did it right, right? None of us will do it completely right. You know, we're human, right? We mess up. That's just who we are. That's the nature of just being human. So I don't have the answer, but I think that it's such a good and important question.
Did you hear Colson Whitehead? He gave the AWP address a couple years ago, and he had a long riff about cultural appropriation, and he said, if it works, it's art, right? Like, and if it sucks, then it's cultural appropriation.
Right, you see?
His advice was like, don't F it up. That was like his big advice about doing that.
Yeah, so. But beyond that, good luck trying to figure out how not to F it up.
Yeah.
I think my question aligns with that is, why did you choose Ghana and Tanzania instead of your native, your home, Nigeria?
Oh, I write about Nigeria all the time. Actually, Miriam here has another novel that is all about her, what her life was in Nigeria, right? But I wanted to write about other parts of, I'd also gone to Tanzania, I'd gone to Nigeria, I'd gone to Ghana. Like, I felt that, again, this is where it gets a little sketchy. I'd been all over Ghana. I've gone to all these places. I've had conversations with Ghanaians. In fact, the people who helped me with, and this is starting to sound a little funny, but in any case, I'll just say that I knew that I was going to restrict myself to only the tourist perspective, right? I wasn't going to go beyond that. I was very careful because as an African, I know that there's a lot of differences within the individual countries, even within each country, right? So I was only going to go from the tourist perspective of things. And also, the point of the novel was not necessarily Africa by itself. It was this sort of like conversation about like the gaze, you know, and what a novel like that looks like from, or what a trip like that looks like from a character like Harry's perspective, right? So that was just what I was trying to do. And Tanzania and Ghana were countries I'd actually been in for a substantial amount of time, and I didn't want to, you know, pretend to know any other country as well as I knew them outside of Nigeria. But in terms of Nigeria, I have Miriam's story continues in Nigeria, is actually starting off in Nigeria. It just happens that they go on study abroad to other countries later on.
And there's some quite good comedy in that Ghana part, I thought, particularly when they're touring the slave fort.
Yeah, I hope you see that that's the thing. So, like, humor is one of those things where we don't, everybody's sense of humor is different. So I'm glad that you saw the humor. and I hope you will see the humor as well.
You will sign books upstairs?
Yes, I will.
And I just want to thank everyone for coming, and thank you for your good questions, and thank you, Chinelo, for your reading and your book.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Asali. Thank you, Andy and Laura. Thank you to the audience. It's such an honor to be here.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.